College equals freedom, freedom equals fun, and fun equals heavy drinking and casual sex. Or so the hookup culture on today's campuses leads students to believe. While college has always been a space for protest, for play, and for breaking the rules, the hookup that has come to dominate campus life is entirely new in its potential for both pleasure and pain. From Ivies to religious colleges, public universities to liberal arts schools, hookup culture is the ubiquitous new culture of sex on campuses today. In her new book, American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus, Professor Lisa Wade looks past the shock value news reports, moralizing op-eds, and party-saturated Hollywood movies to uncover what hookup culture means to college students, how it works, and what it reveals about privilege, power, and the future of sexuality in America. Lisa Wade is an associate professor of sociology at Occidental College with degrees in philosophy, human sexuality, and sociology. Again, the name of the book is American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus, and we welcome Lisa Wade to the roundtable.
My pleasure.
Very nice to have you on the program. What led you down this path of looking at this culture, the new culture, as you call it, of sex on campus?
Well, I was sort of having two experiences at the same time. I was reading the media coverage of this thing called hookup culture, and I was also teaching college classes about the sociology of sexuality. And I was hearing really different stories from those two places. There was the media coverage and then my own students, who seemed both so much wiser and more insightful and funnier and more creative than the media coverage would suggest, and also a lot more diverse and telling a much wider array of stories than I was hearing in the media. And so I started to listen to them more and more carefully, and then I decided to formalize my curiosity and make it a research project, and the rest is history.
So the name of the new book, American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus. So how is sex on campus now different than it was, say, 20, 30, 40 years ago?
A few decades ago, there was casual sexual encounters happening on campus. And that's true from the beginning of college. There was always casual sexual encounters. In fact, before there were both men and women on campus, there were sexual encounters happening. So that's not unusual at all. And in fact, the number of students that are having sexual encounters of any kind are not that different than it has been in previous decades. So today's college student reports the same number of sexual partners, for example, as their parents did at their age. But the culture is really different. So if on previous campuses and previous decades, casual sex was happening, now it's expected and even seen as the only good way to get through college and have a good time.
And it would seem with that criteria that would increase the numbers.
It does, right? But the truth is that cultures, everyone has to sort of contend with whatever cultural space they're in. But we're not cultural dupes, and we don't just obey for lots of different reasons. And the same is true on campus. I mean, for example, you know, it's culturally appropriate in America to get married before having children, but not everybody does it that way, right? And in the same way, it's culturally appropriate on college campuses to be uninterested in love relationships, uninterested in romantic relationships, and interested only in sort of quick, hot, and meaningless, as they would say, sexual encounters. But not everyone's participating. And in fact, both my study and other studies show that about a third of students will not have a single hookup in their entire college career.
So let us begin there with the definition of hookup.
Well, we're going to have a long conversation then, because no one knows what it means. The students don't know what it means. And if the students don't know, then the researchers certainly can't pin it down. And it's deliberately ambiguous. It's ambiguous on purpose. There is this sort of exciting sort of way in which students can talk about what they're doing and not talk about what they're doing and allow other people to insinuate and upplay or downplay what's really happening. So there's no real definition. But we can ask them, and we have, what did you do in the last thing that you would call a hookup? So we can get actual data. And if we ask that question, then, and we have a very, very good data set that has about 24,000 students in it called the Online College Social Life Survey. If we ask that, when we ask those students what they did in their last hookup, allowing them to define hookup however they like, then about 40% of the time they say that they had intercourse. And the rest of the time, well, about a third of the time, they kind of just got horizontal and got a little hot and heavy, kept their clothes on. And the rest of the time they did something in between.
You refer to in the book the phrase as meaningless sex. How did that become defined?
Oh, it's so interesting. So I think the best way to introduce the idea is that we understand as Americans that sex is often and maybe even ideally incredibly meaningful, and that it takes place in relationships that are emotional and committed and characterized by a lot of kindness and caring, where we're taking care of one another, and we want the best things for each other. We want each other to have a wonderful time in life and in sex. So students understand this. You know, they're members of our culture too. And what has happened is that there's been this bifurcation of sexual activity. So if committed, often monogamous relationships are the site of sex that's characterized by care, then they've decided that non-committed sexual engagements are opposite of that in every possible way. So if it's not committed, then there's no care involved, no kindness, no courtesy, no emotions that are positive other than lust. And in fact, there was one study where they were asked, students were asked, what do you think is typically felt during a hookup? What are the typical emotions? And the most common answer was lust, which makes sense about, because that's kind of what it's about. And about 2/3 of students said lust. And then the second most common answer, which was said by only 17% of respondents, was nothing. Not, I didn't have a second answer, but assertively nothing. People feel nothing but lust. And so we've sort of decided that if the sex is casual, then it doesn't have anything in it that is warm. It can only be hot, because we're contrasting it so aggressively to this idea of loving, committed sex.
So if I'm understanding all of this correctly, and I've read the book properly, the two points you're getting to is just that, that there is the meaning is out of it, and there is nothing more emotionally attached to it. But also, the other concern is that those who have not partaken in that hookup, of how they are ostracized from other members of the college community.
Yeah, I think there's a number of concerns. And one is that if students aren't interested in having completely meaningless, emotionless, casual sexual encounters, and a lot of students aren't, then they feel like they can't be a part of the college community sometimes at all. And they often use the word isolated to describe how they feel. And that's one problem. And it's a lot of students on campus that are feeling that way, like they're just missing out on what they might call the whole college experience. I think another problem is that even though it's sort of idealized to be able to have emotionless sex, the truth is that our bodies are literally bags of chemistry. You know, our bodies are designed to have emotion. We have emotions when we have breakfast. It's
sure.
Like not something that most students can do, but they, and I'm not just talking about falling in love, which does happen sometimes. I'm talking about all of the emotions that we might have during some sort of sexual encounter, like just affection or nervousness or awe or disgust. I mean, you name it. But they think they're supposed to have none of those emotions. And when they do have feelings of any kind, they often feel like they're failing at this idealized experience. And not many students who are actually participating in hookups can sort of perform it in this perfectly emotionless way. And then I think the final problem is that once we've decided that it's okay to not be nice to your sexual partner, it opens the door for a whole bunch of other ways of treating them that are really toxic. Because we can imagine a world in which people are having casual, caring sexual encounters. We're casual and caring all the time. Like, You know, if you wave someone through at a stop sign because you're not in a hurry, that's very casual and caring. Or, you know, the pregnant lady drops something at the grocery store and you get it for her because she's about to pop, right? That's casual and caring. We can do it. We have just decided that it's not something we do with sex. And that opens the door for a lot of the other problems, like treating each other in an objectifying way, or picking partners based on the status they will bring you, and treating them cruelly in bed or disparagingly, and then of course the sexual assault problem. So I think that this kindness issue is very central.
Lisa Wade is our guest. The name of the new book is American Hookup: The New Culture of Sex on Campus. So talk to us a little bit about what you mean by not being nice, of the encounter not being that means that the sex itself is not pleasurable to one or both parties, or the way that the person is treated at any given time?
It's interesting when you think about it. If two people have decided that sexual intercourse is meaningless, then almost by definition, everything else you could possibly do becomes more meaningful. If sexual intercourse is at the bottom of the hierarchy of possible meaning, then everything else one does potentially is more weighty. And so things like holding hands or cuddling or eye contact or gentle caresses, anything that suggests any sort of attention paying or affection, or even like non-very sexual-based pleasure, is seen as warmth. It's a warm way of interacting. And hookups are not supposed to be warm. They're supposed to be hot and furtive and over. And so you have, like, there's a great New York Times article where a couple men say that they think that holding hands is much more intimate than getting a hand. Or my students that say they've never hugged someone that they've hooked up with in the immediate aftermath. So you have this interesting effort, this performative effort amongst students to try to avoid the impression that they feel any warmth towards one another at all. And then after the hookup, they have this practice of sort of demoting the relationship for a short time, because their logic is that treating a friend in a kind of bad way in the week or two after a hookup is safer and better than actually allowing feelings to develop, because that would be much more complicated. So they sort of demote the relationship, treat each other more distantly afterward, just to reestablish that, nope, that didn't mean anything, that thing we did.
And it's easier to demote the relationship, especially with technology and social media.
It certainly does allow for, you know, if one person reaches out, then the other person has to restrain themselves from replying, mm-hmm. or they have to restrain themselves from reaching out to begin with. I had one student, for example, who, after she hooked up with someone, she deleted his number in her phone so that she couldn't make the mistake of reaching out to him when she knew that that was against hookup culture's rules.
Talk about the role of drinking and particularly heavy drinking in the culture.
Yeah, so I have a number of students, a good strong minority of students, who had never had any type of sexual activity sober. And I think that the common sense notion is that alcohol sort of lubricates the social interaction, it's liquid courage. And that's certainly true, but it also helps to box the sex into this realm of meaninglessness. If students say it very explicitly, if you are drunk, it didn't mean anything. It's a way of performing that sense that this particular sexual interaction doesn't really count. And so I was really cued into this when I started hearing them whispering in these hushed and almost, sacred sounds in these voices when they're talking about sober sex. The phrase sober sex would come up over and over again, or they'd say, they'd have conversations about two people that had had sex sober. And it was obviously incredibly meaningful when two people got together in a sober way. And they say that when you have sex sober, it means you actually like each other and you're doing it on purpose. It doesn't have that air of carelessness that hookups are all about. And so if one wants to do sex the way that hookup culture asks them to do, then getting drunk enough to be able to say that they had sex carelessly is how they do it.
You address this in the book, and I'm hoping you can give us some idea as to the ways that men and women are treated differently in hookup culture.
You know, it's interesting because many women are coming to campus very excited about the possibility of having sexual encounters with people who, in ways that will allow them to sort of learn about and explore their sexualities and not necessarily be sort of emotional or committed. A lot of women are very excited about doing that, and a lot of men as well. But the sort of ways in which hookup culture is organized structurally privileges men in a way that makes the actual experience less pleasant for women. And partly that's because on most college campuses, and I wouldn't say all, but on most college campuses, men are really in charge of the big parties that especially freshmen want to go to. So in a classic example, it might be the fraternities. And this is a very specific outcome of really particular policies. So when we moved the drinking age, for example, from 18 to 21, and that happened in between 1984 and 87, after a federal law was passed related to transportation, then it became illegal for people who were under 21 to drink in their residence halls. And once that was true, then if they wanted to drink like they're told college students should, then they either have to go to get a fake ID and go out to bars, which can feel sort of dangerous to some students and can actually have some pretty heavy penalties, or they have to go to big houses that throw big parties in the neighborhood. And a lot of times these are frat houses, or they're other big houses that are sort of rented by groups of men. Most sororities are not allowed to throw parties with alcohol. So sororities can't control the party life. So the party life is really in the hands of men, and they tend to be the most privileged men. I mean, fraternities have always been a space for elite, white, class, privileged students to get together, men to get together. And they more or less still are the traditional social fraternities. And so partying in college, especially for freshmen, is sort of handed over on a silver platter to this very particular slice of men. And they tend to be the men who are most invested in hookup culture.
So when you look at that, that the women are basically collateral in this contest to validate masculinity.
That is often how it goes down, yep. So if they want to go to the parties, they have to perform the particular version of sexually available femininity that the men want and reward.
So this gets to the most sobering part of the book, that is, one in six of the women that you look at in this culture is sexually assaulted.
It's a very serious problem. And many men are being sexually assaulted as well.
Given the meaningless nature of it, how do you get to the root of the problem? I mean, if you're starting at a point where neither party really, quote unquote, cares, then how do you get to the root of the problem? Because there has to be some caring if that person isn't going to be assaulted or abused.
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? So when we tell people you must get consent before having sexual contact with someone, it does have this, there's this presumption that we care what the other person feels and wants and desires and thinks. And I think our conversation is a little bit too focused on that line between consent and not consent. I feel like if you look at sex on a spectrum, there's really thoughtful, like, I really want you to be present with me and I really want us to have a lovely experience together, whether it's casual or not. And then on the other end of this spectrum is perhaps sexual assault, where the person doesn't care at all about what the other person feels. I feel like where the line between consent and not consent is really actually quite close. It's right up there, up against sexual assault, right? What I would like is for that middle ground to be more problematized when we talk about what's happening on college and college campuses. So I would like us to sort of back up from that line and say, not only do we need consent, but we need to be kind and thoughtful to each other. We need to be paying attention. We need to sort of get rid, if we can, of some of the sexual activity that isn't exactly criminal, but is still really terrible and really cruel and really, thoughtless. And so what I would love is for us to start to back away from that line. I'd love us to be having conversations that where we're telling students, you're not just entitled to be asked for consent. You're entitled to be treated well overall and in an overarching way. And I feel like that's really missing from a lot of our conversation.
You talk about in the book, and I think that this is really interesting, and obviously it depends on the campus, but it is, you use the term male elites, and that so much of this rape culture can be covered up to protect financial interests. So what exactly can you do to level that playing field?
So when we look at the problem of sexual assault on campus, and when we look at the more toxic features of hookup culture, a lot of that is being nurtured in these elite male spaces. And fraternities are the most sort of classic example of that. But there's right. other all-male spaces on campus that are places where a particular version of masculinity is cultivated. And so that is a serious problem for cultural change on college campuses. The tricky part is that those spaces tend to be in these very codependent relationships with the colleges themselves. So, for example, fraternities provide incredible amounts of housing for students. And if we just eliminated fraternities and sororities, then colleges would have to spend millions of dollars building more residence halls and finding ways to house students. They also attract students because a lot of young people, they want the big, massive parties when they go to college. So if universities started saying, oh, we don't have that for you here, they might actually lose applicants. And colleges and universities don't want to do that, especially when it's the partiers that tend to be full pay tuition. They tend to pay full tuition instead of getting scholarships. And of course, there's the problem of alumni donations. So the Greek life on campus is associated with much higher donations later on, largely because the students that end up going Greek are already class privileged. And so after college, they'll have more money to donate. So colleges and university administrators will often say, we couldn't possibly get rid of these all-male institutions, which to me just says, if you really feel so powerfully dependent on fraternities that you couldn't imagine fighting them, then that's all the more reason to really examine your relationship with them. So I would like to see these all-male social institutions ended. I think that that's really important for moving forward and creating a kinder and more nurturing sexual opportunity for students.
So final question, you do make the point in the book that college campuses have always been a place of cultural revolution. Do you see that revolution happening now, and especially in light of all of the scandals?
Yes. Culture is interesting because in a way it exists in all of us and none of us at the same time. So it isn't cultural if it's just in my head, but it's cultural if it's in all of our heads at the same time. But it also exists only there. So the minute we collectively decide to stop thinking a certain way, that blinks out of existence. Like, we can change culture just by deciding to think differently about what we want, about what's possible. And so even though culture has a lot of inertia because it's collective, and as individuals, we can't just decide that it should be different, it also is very vulnerable to us sort of taking charge of our lives and deciding we want things to be different. And so I think that in colleges in particular, because they're sort of insular, these residential colleges have these sort of insular cultural experiences, all it would take is a critical mass of students to say, we're not doing this anymore. Like, not necessarily casual sex, but we're not doing casual sex like that anymore. And then things could change, I think, very rapidly. And if institutions support that change by making sure that the most toxic features aren't being nurtured and cultivated in these powerful male spaces on campus, then I think we could change the culture on the sexual culture on campus really actually quite quickly. And then students could simply socialize new groups of freshmen into a different way of doing things.
Lisa Wade is an associate professor of sociology at Occidental College with degrees in philosophy, human sexuality, and sociology. The name of the new book is American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus. It is published by Norton. Lisa Wade, I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, American Hookup, published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.